Welcome to the Procurement Show.
Hello and welcome to the Procurement Show, the show that tackles the topics we all need to think about and sets out to explore the more interesting bits of procurement. I'm Jonathan O'Brien.
And I'm Paul Philpott. I'm here to iron Jonathan's cashmere sweaters and fold them in a very special way.
Thank you. This week we are exploring the challenges in implementing effective supplier relationship management in a global organization. And we thought that in order to understand this, we need a big company with lots of different types of suppliers and business areas. So we went for one of the biggest ones that we could find.
The Procurement Show is brought to you by Positive Purchasing, enabling the future of procurement in organizations around the globe.
Jabil is one of the biggest companies on the planet, with annual revenues exceeding $34 billion. It has more than 140,000 employees across 100 locations in 28 countries. It is a global manufacturing company and is the company that you may not necessarily have heard of, but sits behind more than 400 of the biggest brands in the world in every marketplace, from healthcare, energy and cloud storage to automotive and home appliances. To help us understand how to make SRM happen in a big company, our guest this week has 30 years working in procurement in a variety of strategic roles and has worked his way up to become VP of Global Procurement for Jabil. He joins us now from Florida. Please welcome to the Procurement Show, Graham Scott. Graham, hello. It's great that you could join us on the Procurement Show.
Thank you, Jonathan. Glad to be on. Appreciate it.
So Jabil is huge, and I can only begin to contemplate the sort of levels of spend and complexities of supplier relationships that you have to contend with. And you head up the SRM program, amongst other things, for Jabil. So how did this start, or rather, where did you start?
You mentioned it's part of my role. So as a VP of Direct Procurement, I'm responsible for our global centralized quotes team, our global centralized procurement team, our global commodity management team, and our SRM team. And if we go back maybe 7-8 years, we didn't have an SRM organization. Mm-hmm. From a data perspective, we had really good data coming in from our quotes team. We had a commodity management organization, which they work in traditional or typical commodity management type functions. They're negotiating pricing, mm-hmm. they're creating contracts, they're making sure that business awards are made to our supply partners. But what we felt and what we were starting to recognize was that we were missing a deeper relationship with our suppliers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as I mentioned, 7-8 years ago, we decided to put together a team that was effectively going to help us drive those relationships at the executive level within the supply base and allow the commodity management organization to work on the things that we expected them to work on. So again, the pricing side of things, the negotiations, the supply assurance, all that sort of stuff, while we had this separate organization that was thinking a little bit further out, maybe a little bit more strategic about the relationship and where we could be heading as a customer to those particular suppliers.
As we all know, the key to SRM is deciding which suppliers to work with and mm-hmm. where you spend our precious resources, even if they are something in the region of $34 billion. How did you go about this? How do you start to segment the supply base? How do you decide what's important and what are the challenges that you encountered? And also, are there any more points I can include in the same question?
Yeah, that's a good question, Paul. We are a large, complex company. You know, I think if you look at the total number of suppliers we cover, both on direct and indirect, it's north of 30,000 suppliers.
Wow.
So obviously, we can't have a deep relationship with every single one of those suppliers. So we had to really think about, how are we going to look at this? And we didn't want to look at just the commercial value of the relationship. So not, you know, just say, okay, here's our top spend suppliers. Although that's a consideration, it wasn't the be all and end all. You know, just because you're a large supplier to Jabil doesn't necessarily mean that there's a need for that longer term vision, that longer term strategy, because it could be just for one customer. It might be a specific product that doesn't really have the breadth across the markets that we cover. So, you know, we kind of looked at it from four angles beyond the commercial relationship. So we looked at the markets they were serving. We looked at the customers they were serving. We were looking at the applications they supported, and then the technology that they were providing to Jabil. So we were looking at those four elements and trying to think, does this fit our long-term strategy? Does this fit the vision of our customers as well and where they're going? And we took that, we looked at the commercial value again, thinking about the spend, the relationship that we had with them today, and thought, okay, let's narrow this down to the 120 that tick most of those boxes. So we ended up with, you know, effectively six portfolios of suppliers. So we had like high IP semiconductors, things like microprocessors, controllers, memory. We had the analog, logic, discrete space. So that was a second semiconductor portfolio. We created a portfolio for passive and interconnect suppliers, PCB portfolio, a distribution portfolio. And then finally, you know, a big part of our supply base is our Japanese supply partners. And the way that we had to not create, because we had relationships, but develop relationships with that supply base is a little bit different. We felt that we had to have somebody in Japan to help with those relationships. So we then had a Japanese portfolio as well. So those were the six distinct portfolios that we ended up creating in order to manage those roughly 120 supply partners.
And I'm really intrigued by and encouraged by the fact that you recognize that there are geographical differences in terms of how we interface with suppliers. Very different in Japan, very different in China as well, in terms of how you have those relationships. So that's fascinating. When you started the process of engaging with those suppliers, how did they respond? What happened in that process? Did everybody encourage this and welcome this, or was there resistance?
I don't think there was resistance, Jonathan. And there was a lot of shock and surprise. As a company, you know, we were put in this EMS bucket, and, you know, the EMS space historically had a certain way of managing suppliers. And, you know, this was very different. So they were a little bit surprised by the tactic we were taking. You know, I think we've always taken pride in the fact that we do manage our relationships with our supply partners a little differently and a little better. This was like a cherry on top of that. You know, we were basically looking to elevate those relationships, change the dynamics a little bit. And to be honest, the surprise probably came in the timing of when we actually approached those suppliers, because it was very much a buyer's market, very similar to perhaps what, you know, many of your listeners are probably experiencing today in the electronics market. You know, there was an abundance of inventory, pricing was, you know, maybe moving in a kind of more downward fashion rather than what we've seen in the last couple of years in the semiconductor space in particular, where it's been increasing. So they were looking at us going, whoa, what's going on here? Why are you saying that you're setting this up? You've got a long-term strategy when, you know, in fact, most customers are coming to us and starting to beat us up, asking for cost reductions, being more aggressive because the market had turned. Yeah, I think the initial reaction was one of surprise rather than resistance. I can't think of any supplier conversation that we had at that time where somebody said, we don't like this concept, we don't like the idea. Everybody bought into it pretty much immediately. I think there was some trust already there with Jabil. You know, as I said, we kind of pride ourselves in our behavior. So we had this behavioral ethos that we've put together, and we call it our 4C strategy, which is, again, something that's been around for a number of years. And there was a belief that what we were actually telling them was true.
What's the 4C strategy?
Everybody in procurement, everybody in supply chain in Jabil. In fact, everybody in Jabil, let's be honest, anybody who's dealing with a supplier, we ask them to behave in a way that enables us to differentiate ourselves from our peers and perhaps even, you know, some of our customers in some respect. We talk about communication. You know, let's make sure that we're communicating effectively. We're not over-communicating, we're not under-communicating, we're not escalating directly into CEOs from buyer levels. You know, we follow processes, hierarchies, all that sort of stuff. We're consistent in our approach. You know, we don't want to flip-flop strategies every 90 days. You know, we're not coming to them with something new every 90 days or every month and saying, hey, we've changed our mind, we want to do something different now. We're very consistent in that procurement approach. We push for credibility. You know, if I think of an example there, if we are negotiating with a supplier and we say we are going to award you this business, we expect that to carry through to a purchase order. You know, it's not a case of sitting in a negotiation and saying, yeah, we'll give you an order for that just to get a lower cost to then beat up another supplier. We like that kind of credibility. The more credible that we are, I think the deeper the relationship gets with the supplier. And then finally, collaboration. We want our suppliers to think of us as the first port of call when they've got something new to work on. And similarly, what we do when we've got a new initiative or whatever, we will sit with those key 120 suppliers and we'll open it up to them first, and we'll try and find a way to collaborate in a more effective manner. You know, and that could be investments in digital solutions. It could be a different way of looking at working capital, anything like that. That more collaborative approach where we're not basically saying, this is what you need to do. We're asking our partners to come on board with us.
That seems like a really good balanced approach because, Jonathan, I'm sure you'll agree that the key to any good supplier relationship is in the phrase, the relationship itself. And even after it's been broken down, that Graham's just done, it still seems quite a daunting task, doesn't it, without those key pointers?
Well, you can look at a supplier relationship just like a human relationship. If you don't work at it, if you don't communicate, if you're not consistent with your partner, if they don't think you have credibility, and if you're not working with them, collaborating them. Well, that's just a story of my marriage. Yeah. So if you don't have any of that stuff, then I'm only joking. Yeah. I'm sorry, in case she's listening.
The Procurement Show. Exploring the more interesting bits about procurement. And now, the procurement fun fact. This edition's exciting tale of preposterous procurement, bizarre buying, or simply saucy sourcing.
The biggest thing ever shipped was the Egyptian obelisk known as Cleopatra's Needle that now stands in Central Park, New York. The 200-ton obelisk was shipped from Alexandria in Egypt in 1881 and was so big that in order to get it aboard the steamship, the crew had to cut a hole in the side of the boat. When it arrived in New York, it had to be transported by 32 horses to drag it from the East River. The city removed railroad tracks and then flattened the ground so the obelisk could be rolled along towards its final destination. The delivery driver then delivered it to the wrong place and sent a text saying your delivery is complete, along with a photo of it outside somebody else's front door, leaving New York authorities to walk the neighborhood until they found the door in the photo to collect the obelisk.
Some of that was true.
The Procurement Fun Fact. Contact us by email. hello@theprocurementshow.com. Send us a tweet at Procurement Show, or connect with us on LinkedIn. Search for The Procurement Show.
What do you mean, in case she's listening? Of course she's listening.
We can edit that out.
Well, whatever. No, I'm going to leave it in. But you're saying about they are key strategies, aren't they, John?
They are. And it's just because there are so many parallels here. We treat business-type relationships as if there's something different and you've got to do this magic stuff. It's just like a human relationship. And all of those things come into play. So I love those four C's. Yeah. It really does define it really well in terms of what you have to do. And it is incredibly simple. It's about people. People have relationships with people. People buy people. You know, it's not companies and suppliers, it's the people in those companies and the people in those suppliers. So it's about the relationship.
But even behind this, you're going to have to set some objectives, aren't you? You're going to have to set some goals. So, Graham, how did you decide about the goals and objectives that you wanted to achieve using SRM, and how did you go about doing that initially?
I'd answer that, Paul, by saying, you know, we had some soft objectives and then we had some hard objectives. You know, on the soft side, it was really about the relationship, you know, and how could I have confidence that the SRMs had the ability to pick up the phone and just speak to an executive. So one of the things that we had to do was differentiate the role of SRM and GCM. You know, the GCMs, price, contracts, assurance of supply, they're an escalation point. So I had to make sure that the SRMs were not crossing over into that domain. And when you're talking about price and you're talking about escalations, you know, maybe you're calling a VP of sales and a supplier and they look at the phone and like, oh, you know, it's Graham calling about another part shortage. You know, I don't want to talk to him. I'll let that go to voicemail. I wanted the SRMs to have that relationship with the supplier that they go, oh, it's Graham, the SRM. I'm going to take this call because he's probably got something exciting to talk to me about. So we had to very quickly differentiate the roles and make sure that from a softer perspective, the relationship was maintained at the SRM level with those executives, because we wanted to make sure that should we put a call into them, they're going to take that call. And I think from a softer objective, that worked out really well. Thinking about more in the numerical side and, you know, how we kind of measure the relationships, we looked at various elements. You know, we looked at, was our spend growing? I mean, that's a simple thing. But, you know, obviously, if we've got a relationship and we're trying to deepen that relationship, we want the spend to grow with them. We looked at design engagement, you know, where we're using more of their parts and more of our design to make sure that we were pushing the right technologies from those suppliers. You know, we just looked at some of the more commercial elements of the relationship as well, just to make sure, again, that the fact that we were developing that relationship was then translating into greater commercial value for Jabil.
Let me come back to the collaboration piece, because clearly within those suppliers that you've decided you're going to work with, there's going to be some that you're going to collaborate much more than others. How did you go about actually doing that collaboration? What were the things you put in place to start that process and make sure that you were getting the right things from that process?
I think the approach was pretty consistent, Jonathan, across the 120 that we determined were in scope. We did a little bit of a tour of the world. We went and met with, you know, almost all of the suppliers face to face. There was a couple that perhaps we didn't get to, but, you know, of the 120, over 100 we met face to face. We explained the program. We explained what we were looking to do. We explained why we thought it was important to them, not necessarily important to us, but why it was important to them. And we showed them that we were serious about this. You know, we created what we internally co-developed account plans. And basically, we asked those suppliers at that time, you don't need to answer us in the room right now, but tell me 10 things that Jabil can help you with. And we asked them to list them. We got that list maybe a month or so later. We went through that and we said, well, we can do 7 of these. You know, there's 3 asks in here that we're just not going to be able to support. So again, it goes back to that communication and the consistency and the credibility. You know, we're not going to do everything for you, but we can do 7 of them. We're very transparent, very open, very honest. We can work on these 7, but here's 3 or 4 things that we would like as well. And then what we do is we give them our 3 or 4. They look at that and go, hey, Graham, you're crazy. You're asking for 2 things here we can't do. Then we end up in this list of 8 or 9 actions that we then commit to paper. And we say, okay, let's review it in 12 months. We've got an action plan. We know what we're going to work on. We know what you're expecting us to deliver. And after 12 months, we go through that. We check the box and say, okay, done. Do we carry on into the following year? Do we create a new list? And then we do that every single year. So the credibility came from the fact that we showed them that we were willing to do this, and then we've been consistent in that approach over the last 7 or 8 years. So I can't say there was a different approach for different suppliers, because we tried to be as consistent as we could with the approach. And whether you were a passive supplier, a PCB supplier, a distributor, a semiconductor manufacturer, we kind of approached it the same way, if I'm being honest.
One thing I'm noticing is that in all the recent episodes that we've been doing, AI and the discussion of automotive relationships and data analysis and just using AI to make the decisions for us and driving the business forward has been very much a buzz phrase and buzz point of discussion. Yet what you're saying here, you're going back to embracing personal interactions and personal relationships, aren't you? It's quite an uplifting discussion, I think.
Paul, it's obviously a topic of conversation internally as well, and it'd be remiss of me to say that we weren't looking at AI and how we can use AI, but we're not thinking about it as a relationship tool. It's more to help our experts in managing their commodities, their supplier portfolios, whatever it may be. You know, we're kind of looking at it from that side, not to maintain and develop the relationship. If I was to consider the last 3 years, going back to COVID, through that 3-year period after COVID first came to light, suppliers are making decisions on who they're going to support with product. And, you know, if we don't have that relationship and we don't have that depth of relationship, then we're going to be in a situation where we're just considered another number, another customer name in a box. And we wanted, again, to differentiate ourselves. We want to stand out from the industry that we're in. We want our supply partners to look at us differently, to consider us differently. Yeah, is AI going to know that? Probably not, right? So if we have those depth in the relationships that we're pushing for, then, you know, whoever's making those decisions on the customer side is going to say, that's for Jabil. You know, that's a Jabil customer. We need to make sure that we look after those guys. That was what I saw as a benefit from the SRM organization over those last couple of years, that, you know, we've got that relationship to the point where I do believe that we get perhaps a little bit more support. Hard to quantify what that little bit is, but, you know, if you look at Jabil's revenue growth through one of the most tumultuous times in supply chain history, I think it kind of indicates that we've done a nice job in making sure that we remain consistent with the supply base through the markets.
Because there's been some pretty significant crises, obviously the pandemic. But I mean, in your industry, if we go back to 2018, where there was the big passives crisis, the shortage of passive components, have you actually seen that? Can you point to the fact that because we have better relationships with those suppliers, and the phrase I hear a lot is, you were the customer of choice, that your suppliers had prioritized you, where suddenly the suppliers were having their day in the sun, limited capacity, they could only satisfy so many of their customers. Suppliers were choosing which customers, and some thought, hey, we'll put our prices up. Others thought, no, that's perhaps going to come back and bite us in 12 months' time. No, we'll just serve our customers who we see the biggest future with. Did you actually see that? Can you point to that?
100%, without drinking, you know, our own Kool-Aid and believe in our own market hype or whatever. When we talk to supply partners and even customers, you know, we do hear that the Jabil approach is different. And because of that, we do get a little bit of an advantage somewhere. Again, it's really hard to quantify, Jonathan. But through 2018 and 2017, 2018, and maybe into the first part of 2019, I can't think of us actually having a major supply disruption. Now, did we have shortages? Yes, we worked shortages all day and all night. Our commodity management team did a fantastic job in making sure we could get through that particular crisis. But it's hard to determine, you know, what that advantage was that perhaps we had over the balance of the market. But you know, we were going and meeting with CEOs of the passive suppliers, and the feedback that we were getting was that you guys are different. You know, you're taking a different approach. And I mentioned that previously, but we didn't have things like buyers escalating directly into VPs of sales and CEOs. And that just creates tension that's not required within the relationship. I think we do a nice job of making sure we escalate appropriately, ensuring that the appropriate people are talking to the executives within the supply base. And you know, there's no screaming, there's no shouting, there's no behavior that could be misconstrued as being overly aggressive. And I have to say, it's not like Jabil is a soft touch. I don't think we are. I think we're appropriately aggressive, but we do it in a manner that we try to be consistent, right? You know, we know that we have to be aggressive in certain markets regardless, right? You know, if it's a seller's market, we have to be aggressive and try to get supply. If it's a buyer's market, we have to be aggressive in getting competitive pricing. The market's going to dictate, you know, which way you're going to move there, but you have to be consistent. You can't change. Your personality still has to be the same. And that's what we've done a nice job of over the last few years, is regardless of which cycle we're going through, we've tried to make sure the characters are consistent and make sure their character is consistent as well.
It's time to Ask Jonathan.
And today's Ask Jonathan comes from Eric Winchester from Maine, who asks, what is the real future of AI in procurement?
Well, that's not a small question,
is
it?
No, not really.
I think the first thing is, forget a lot of what everybody's saying about this, because there's a lot of nonsense on this. AI has a huge future. When people talk about AI is going to change how we do RFPs, forget that. We're not going to be doing RFPs in the future. But what AI will do is it will help us to be able to have much better data-driven strategies in the first place. So we already have access to much bigger data, but we can use the AI to be able to interpret that data, to understand supply options, and to help develop strategies based upon what we know works. So that's the first way it will help. It will clearly help in terms of how we evaluate those suppliers that we're going to do, because it'll be able to analyze lots more data points. It's going to help in terms of how we understand supply chains, because we can use AI to look for anomalies for things that happen remotely, perhaps using things like satellite data to look at the farmsteads and things where things are produced and be able to spot things that don't seem right and are perhaps impacting our sustainability compliance that we require from those suppliers. And it's also going to help in terms of how we structure contracts and how we manage that stuff. That's pretty straightforward. So there's lots of sort of short-term gains that AI will help you put a contract in place. But longer term, it's about how we have a much more data-driven approach, how we move much towards an intake system. I want to be that. I want to source this thing right now. And it understands the marketplace and all the geopolitical things that are happening in the world at that time to figure out the best approach to sourcing. So it will kind of automate a lot of those things. It's not going to take away the need for really good people who are able to help make sure that that stuff happens. As we keep saying on this program,
AI requires two things to make it work. The first is you've got to be really clear about the goal, the thing you want it to do. And the second is it has to have access to the right data to be able to do its thing. And if those two things aren't in place, it's going to be nonsense. But if you get those two conditions right, then AI is already and will continue to transform how procurement works.
Nice answer, Mr. Jonathan O'Brien. And a good question, Mr. Eric Winchester. If you've got a question for Jonathan, be you be a human or be you be an AI, here's how to get in touch.
Ask Jonathan. Email your question to jonathan@theprocurementshow.com. You might be part of the next show. The Procurement Show. The latest thinking, the greatest insights.
Earlier on, you were talking about the importance of, I guess, supporting each other. Did you come to any stages where you had to invest in your suppliers? You know, and how did you build the challenge of reducing cost or spend when you have to evaluate the cost of the investment? Did you support your suppliers at that kind of level as well?
We didn't make any direct investments in any supplier hall. You know, what I can say is that we invest in those relationships, right? So we invest in people, we invest in processes, we invest in technology in order to support those relationships and drive those relationships. So I guess it's an indirect investment. But again, listening to what our supply partners require from us, you know, we try and help them that way. If they come to us and say, hey, we'll get this new product, you know, we really want to get it to market quicker, we'll be the first to put our hands up and say, okay, let's look at it. Let's try and find an application for it. We could go and talk to specific customers that are geared towards using that particular technology and try and get those suppliers onboarded. Similarly, if they are talking to us about a new initiative that perhaps they have internally, we'll always be the first to put our hands up and say, yeah, get us involved as early as you want. You know, let us understand what it is you're trying to achieve and we'll try and help you get there. So not direct investments, but indirect investments in the relationship that help drive things forward.
And what about measurement? Have you found that you've needed to measure suppliers perhaps more than you were before, perhaps less? Are you more precise in how you're measuring stuff? How does measurement fit within what you're doing for SRM within Jabil?
We have two different ways of measuring suppliers, right? So we have our traditional commodity management backed processes, which is really around, you know, are you delivering on time? Are you competitive? Quality levels, you know, your traditional supplier scorecard. So the commodity management team work on that. The SRMs, they're looking at what value are we both getting from the relationship? And they're trying to determine, you know, are we moving that forward positively? Is a positive momentum behind the relationship so that they can then start to showcase what we're doing with those particular suppliers in front of other suppliers, try and get them all moving in the same direction. So again, it's things like design and engineering engagement around these initiatives. You know, how engaged are we with that particular supplier? It's not the hard metrics that we have in the commodity management side. It's more softer elements around the relationship. Mm-hmm. So it's just a little different.
How far do you take these conversations? And not in terms of the language used, but in terms of how far down the supply chain do you go? Do you go further than your immediate suppliers with all this level of engagement?
It's basically that first level of suppliers. Mm-hmm. We don't go further below as far as the relationships. I mean, we do watch what's going on in the markets and understand how material flow could potentially impact our supply base, but we're not managing our suppliers' relationships, if that makes sense. But we do watch it, for sure.
Thinking about the supply chain, thinking about sustainability, which is obviously something that every company is driving with suppliers and back up the supply chain. Would you say that the SRM program has helped to drive sustainability to meet Jabil's sustainability targets? How has that worked?
Yeah, it's definitely helped, Jonathan. Having that supplier relationship management team, it's given us that inroad into the supply base. And I think sustainability goals are still being somewhat worked out. And if I think about the influx of data that's required, we're still trying to get our arms around that. But having our SRMs talk to our supply partners about, you know, their particular sustainability strategies and how that ties to what ours are, and not just strategy, but also our requirements, has absolutely helped. We're getting in front of the right people. We're talking to the right people within our supply base. We're all working through that at the moment. You know, the whole ESG element of supply chain is something that's top of mind at the moment, something that, you know, all of our supply chain executives within Jabil are pulling our heads together and trying to work out exactly how we're going to approach this, both from an influx of material, but then also what's going out, what we're providing to our customers, the data that we have to provide to them. It's pretty dynamic at the moment as we try and just kind of nail down what's required and what's a nice to have. But, you know, over the course of the next few months, I'm sure we'll get there.
It seems you have some really good conversations with your suppliers. Yeah. And I always find that a conversation is best had over a takeaway.
I know where you're heading.
Yeah, you know where I'm heading with that? Yeah, over a takeaway. Yeah. Other than the food, edible kind of takeaways, what are your three top takeaways, please?
I think it's something that people need to start now if they haven't already done it. So it's timing. Don't wait until the next supply shortage to think, oh, we should have a supplier relationship management team, or we should have a different way of managing our suppliers. I think you have to do it now. You have to start immediately. If you think it's something that's lacking, do it now. Don't wait. My second one would be make sure you get the right people. If you don't have, you know, an expert who can converse with both engineering, the commercial side of the supplier relationship, the technical side of it, then it could be a bit of a struggle. So make sure you get the right talent and the right personalities. Personality is obviously very important, especially when it comes to creating that level of depth in the relationship. If somebody's not got that particular skill set within them, you're probably not going to create it. You know, you're not going to develop somebody to be a supplier relationship guy. You really need to have that within you. And then I would say, genuinely, I spoke about it a couple of times, you know, our behavior. I think behavior is key. You know, you guys hit the nail on the head about how you're approaching things. And if you don't have that behavioral strategy nailed down, and everybody has to buy into it. And I mean, everybody. Our CEO thinks the same way as we do. You know, we have a phrase, treat our suppliers like their customers. And that's unique. And that's even our CEO, right? So it's everybody through the organization, CEO, chief supply chain officer, right down to buyers. So the way that we look at that behavioral side of things is vitally important. Let's make sure that, you know, we can demonstrate a behavior that we would want to see in our customers, if I was being honest.
It's been insightful to hear how Jabil's been approaching supplier relationship management. Some really good thoughts and insights into that. Thank you so much for joining us on The Procurement Show. Graham Scott, it's been a pleasure to have you on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to The Procurement Show. Contact us by email, hello@theprocurementshow.com. Connect with us on LinkedIn, search for The Procurement Show, and on Twitter, @ProcurementShow. Visit us at theprocurementshow.com. The Procurement Show is brought to you by Positive Purchasing, enabling the future of procurement in organizations around the globe. Copyright Positive Purchasing, all rights reserved. Produced by Fresh Air Studios.